This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Matt Jankovic, CXO of Pecona.
Hi, Ian. Glad to be here. I'm Matt Jankovic. I've been in the open source space for over 15 years now. I actually started in the enterprise space, and then I moved over to the wonderful world of open source at MySQL AB. So I was one of those original MySQL ABers, worked there for a couple years, got bought by Sun, didn't want to get bought by Oracle. And at that time, Peter wooed me over into Percona, and I've been at Percona almost consistently. I left for 6 months, but almost consistently for over 10 years now. Very hardcore in the database space early on, and then I moved into the different business areas. I've had lots of different roles here. So those of you who aren't familiar with Percona, Percona was founded by our CEO, Peter Zaitsev, back in 2007. So it's been a while now. He founded it coming out of MySQL AB because he felt that MySQL AB was getting a bit too corporate. They took their first funding rounds, and guess what? They started to think about, how do we return shareholder value instead of help customers? And he thought, I need to keep those guys honest. So he started Percona to keep MySQL honest, and then Oracle honest, and then MongoDB honest, and everything else. So we kind of view our role as keeping open source in the database space as open as possible, and also to help customers get the most value and keep those other guys honest as well.
What a laudable approach.
It's a little different than most database companies, I will admit.
It is a challenge though, open source, isn't it, in terms of knowing how to utilize it, how to take it forward?
Yes, it's a total challenge because I think there's a lot of business models out there that have been brought up around open source. And what's funny is open source isn't a business model. But because people have been successful with open source and have learned how to monetize it, a lot of people with open core, everybody's jumped on the bandwagon. And so now when you talk to certain people out there, you start to hear them say like, oh, well, I chose open source because I can make money off of it. And it's like, wait a minute, that's not why you choose open source. That's not where open source started. But you start to see that. And it's this shift when you start an open source project and you get really passionate about that project and people start to adopt it. It's this great feeling. But then people start to adopt it in these corporate spaces and they don't contribute back. And then it becomes this, oh, well, I need to support them and I need to help get that further. So you start looking for money and then that starts to propel you into different directions. And so I think that that is this difficult pivot for a lot of smaller companies, a lot of smaller open source projects to get that. How do you get revenue? And from a Percona perspective, we believe in everything we ship should be open. Where we make our money is helping customers find better value in open source. So we help support, manage service, consulting, those types of things. Follow more of a Red Hat-esque model, if you will, with the subscription.
One of the things that came out of your survey, which is part of the big news you've got here at the conference, was you actually asked customers how many of you contribute back.
Yes.
And over 60% said, we don't.
And that's what's funny. It's interesting because I do think that people sometimes minimize their contributions because here's the thing. When you come to this conference or you come to a Red Hat conference or you come to KubeCon that's coming up at the end of this year, even attending and going, that's some level of contribution from some of these companies. And that's always a good starting point for people because just showing that you care and learning more and starting to propagate, that's a good contribution in and of itself. But when we're talking about code contributions, especially when you're in an enterprise, when you're in a company, a lot of it is you're looking for open source to be more turnkey, and so you don't have the time to contribute. What we're finding is there are some people who are willing to contribute dollars or some people who are willing to contribute time, but the vast majority of people are just willing to contribute the knowledge and help propagate that community. And I think that's okay. We'd love to have more contributors across the board, but it is interesting that so many people just decide, hey, we're going to consume and not actually contribute back.
That's interesting because amongst the other things that jumped out for me were three. The first was the multi-cloud, which we'll come back to in a minute. The second was the issue with Kubernetes and what that means for databases, which to me just seems like another revisitation of virtual machines. But again, I'll come back to that. And the third one that jumped out to me from here was that people are trying to solve problems here. The number of them running large numbers of instances. You have some of your enterprise customers saying we run 10,000 plus instances.
Oh, yeah.
So that must raise some very interesting questions as to whether they're just boilerplating or whether there's difference between these, but also that issue of scale-up integration.
Oh, yeah.
But how many of those customers realize as they start to solve that, it's a problem other people are going to have. So actually, there's a contribution issue here in terms of management. It doesn't have to be code. It can simply be in playbooks.
Oh my gosh, yes, that is a huge issue. When we talk about this, it follows the whole cloud native computing process. Now it's instead of managing pets, they manage cattle. That philosophy, you've heard that before. That's not new. What you've got is you've got people who are deploying databases for every microservice. That means that, hey, how many microservices do you have? And how many instances of those microservices are spun up? And a lot of them have their own individual databases. So now all of a sudden that just escalates and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. What you're finding is you have to have tools that help manage that and manage it at scale. Because what used to be, oh, I've got 20 databases, now I've got 100, now I've got 1,000, now I've got 10,000, and they just proliferate. That is a huge challenge, especially in the enterprise space, but not just in the enterprise space. A lot of our mid-sized companies still have thousands of databases. And this is where I think you mentioned Kubernetes, which we'll get back to in a second, but that's where you'll see Kubernetes or even some of the databases as a service from some of the cloud providers become popular, because it helps manage that in a way that is automated and consistent across the board, because the consistency is important, because you can't manage that many effectively, especially when the number of people who are being paid or hired to manage it is decreasing every day. It's less and less people to manage more and more servers. And that is something that I don't see changing. It's just getting worse. When a problem happens, it escalates quickly, especially with automation. Automation's great, but it automates both good and bad. When you start off, you automate a bad thing, that becomes 10,000 bad things or 100,000 bad things. And it's interesting is you look at a lot of the cloud providers who have had outages this past year, and you trace back the reason. A lot of it's due to automation. And they've taken like a configuration, they've taken some tool to manage, whether it's their database or one of their other servers, clicked a button, blown it out and crossed 100,000. They didn't test it properly. And now all of a sudden you've got 10,000 issues.
That Kubernetes problem that we alluded to just now, I'm slightly confused by this. I sat at KubeSec in Seattle end of last year and heard people talking about the fact they got containers with hundreds of gigabytes of data in them, which rather blew my mind, the idea that you have containers of that sort of size. You know, microservice, yes. Data, why? But you're saying that you've got customers who are spinning up a microservice and alongside it a database, which again I find slightly odd. It doesn't seem to scale naturally to me. What sort of things are they doing it for, and how do you manage that?
We've done some work to try and open source some of the stuff that our customers have done. We've also have a community blog where you try and get people to contribute a webinar. This is how we did this. Come to the conference, talk at the conference, and tell people how you built your infrastructure. We have Slack here. Slack has a massive amount of servers. We wanted them to talk about how they built that. And that's really important for us to get that view from the different people, because a lot of people, they want to say, well, how did this other company do it? How did that company do it? The challenge with that is a lot of what some of these companies do is so unique to their business, it doesn't always translate. So you have to take the nuance and be able to read between the lines that A works, B doesn't work, and then figure out which one actually will work for you. Some of that contribution coming back, like I said, it's about being part of the community. It's about being able to talk. It's about being able to put out some blogs, put out some knowledge, put out some education. And that contribution is just as valuable, especially as we go through and get better and better tool sets.
So it's not so much a relationship of container to database, but it's a block of containers hosting instances of a service to a database.
There's a few different things that they're doing it for. Most of your applications need some sort of database. Some of these are transient and some of them are geolocated. So you have service in Europe, a service in the US, or maybe multiple in each, and they'll have their own individual database. Some will have a consolidated database cluster that they point to. What you're seeing is it's that just the mentality of spinning up the additional microservices, spinning up each individual thing as you need load. And if you think about now, even in cloud space, we've gone full circle back to the 90s, where if you have a problem, what do? You throw hardware at it. If you have a problem now, what do? You throw additional instances at it. You throw bigger instances at it. You start to scale out, and that solves your problem until it doesn't, until you run out of room. That's where we're at with a lot of these is, I've heard somebody say performance and scale by credit card. That's what it is in the cloud. When we're talking about Kubernetes and you're talking about adding these additional, I think that people have grown comfortable to this expansion and shrinkage of resources quickly. One of the things that Kubernetes and containers do is allow you to spin those up and destroy them very quickly and then start to move them.
And that neatly brings us back to the multi-cloud. I was amazed at how many of your customers who responded to the survey are using multiple clouds. Now, is that because they're deploying their container environments into multiple clouds and then they're deploying the database afterwards? Or are they using different clouds for discreetly different applications?
It could be one database or it could be multiple. You see one-to-one sometimes. It just depends on the service. But the vast majority are going to use a consolidated database, and they're going to use a cluster. We have our own operators that run PXE. You've heard Glera. You've heard MariaDB Glera. All similar clusters, NODB cluster, which is MySQL. Putting that behind a group of containerized services is really helpful because then you have the redundancy. If you lose one of your application microservices, you just spin up additional, but then you have the redundancy in the back end and the database side. So if you lose a node, another node can be added and it can propagate. And you have the consolidated data across the board for all of those applications.
But how do customers then keep things like data in sync? It's one thing to have multiple redundant systems, but the challenge for databases has always been synchronization of this.
It's a mix. It really is. And what's interesting about the multi-cloud space is, from a multi-cloud perspective, this is really a play, when I talk to customers, about vendor lock-in. They're viewing the cloud as the new vendor lock-in. And to avoid that, they don't want to get locked into just AWS or Microsoft or Google. They want to be able to say, whichever one meets our needs, whichever one is less expensive, whichever one is the better friend to us, that's where we're going to deploy. And if that changes, we want the portability to move around. Because sometimes you get locked in, you get into these stacks, you start to deploy proprietary versions of open source, which seems odd, of some of these, and you get in there and it's like the Hotel California. You check in, you can't leave. That scares people, especially the people who went through the early database days where Oracle, IBM would do this play, which is they would come in, you would deploy their software, and to get out, it was a multi-million dollar effort. The prices every year would raise, and then their shareholder value would raise, and everyone would be happy, and then all of a sudden, you're stuck with this huge bill. And that's what people are afraid of. But on top of that, people starting to realize that while there is a ton of technology in these big companies, not all of the technology is up all the time. While we've put a whole bunch of effort into making these technologies scale and to make them bulletproof, outages happen a lot. Just Google cloud outage, and you'll find dozens of articles. Just Google massive application outage, Facebook and Twitter, and all these companies go down. And these are companies that have massive budgets to put behind their IT departments. And so when you start to realize that, yeah, even these giants have bad days, and they happen quite often. If you can't have a bad day, if your application can't have a bad day, what are you going to do? Well, you spread the risk. And that's when you start to see, it's really interesting to see some of these IPOs that come out from Snapchat and others. They have big contracts with both Amazon and Google, or Microsoft and Google, and combinations, because they deploy to both, because they know their application has to have the most uptime possible.
But how do they guarantee that portability? If I look at Cloud Foundry, they've done a very good job to minimize the number of distributions and ensure that those distributions are tight when it comes to moving between them.
There's replication technologies to try and help with this. There's cross-cloud. But here's the thing. The cloud vendors don't like to play with one another. They don't, because they have a business reason not to play with one another. Let's be honest. As these cloud providers develop their database technologies, as they deploy, it becomes harder and harder to go cross-cloud. And that's where you're seeing some of the Kubernetes start to jump up. Being able to deploy MySQL or Postgres or MongoDB in Kubernetes on top of Amazon or on top of Azure or on top of GCP, that allows them to have the portability and have the exact same stack on each one, and then they can replicate between them.
If I look at Kubernetes, we're in excess of 70 different official distributions as of this moment in time.
Yes.
Now, as somebody who grew up in the Unix era, where even Kernighan and Ritchie C wouldn't be guaranteed to compile on everybody's platform, let alone in Formix C and IBM's C products, how do we convince people that going containers actually is that portability solution?
This is where it gets interesting. From a Kubernetes perspective, you're right. There's way, way more different versions and intercompatibilities. But I think that what you're seeing is you're starting to see some of the top ones rise to the top. OpenShift in the enterprise, everybody's looking at OpenShift. That's something VMware just bought Pivotal, and so now they're trying to combine into their thing. You're going to see some consolidation there, so that's going to help. Sticking with the larger vendors, that's going to give you the opportunity to use some of the technology that's being built for it. Our operators, for instance, we are certified on OpenShift. We've also got a couple other ones that we've guaranteed that they work on, but we're trying to limit that to the most popular. Our commitment is the most popular databases on the most popular platforms. That's what we want to do, is figure out where we're seeing the most. And so you're always going to see these oddball ones, and those are one of those second, third tier Kubernetes releases. That's where you're going to see more of the issues. Mm-hmm. Hopefully what we can do across the board as a community, get really good at the top tier and then start to filter down. But yeah, the consistency across those is a challenge. But I'll be honest, the consistency across the database and the technology landscape is a challenge now. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm going to talk about here at the conference is we've really strived for simplification, and we've tried to make things so it's easier. Like Kubernetes, it's designed to make things easier. It's designed to manage all of these microservices, all of these containers, Docker as a whole. What happened is it's gotten really complicated when you have 10,000 things. And in the database space, it's very similar. When you look at the choices that I faced as a DBA 20 years ago, it was, do I want proprietary or do I want open source? And if I want proprietary, I can do SQL Server, Oracle, Sybase, DB2. That's probably it. And if I wanted open source, I could do Postgres or MySQL, and that's pretty much it. That was my choice. Now, when I go to make that choice, it's what platform do I want to run on? Do I want to run on-prem? Do I want to run in the cloud? Do I want to run on hybrid? And then you say, okay, well, I want to run in the cloud. Great. So if you want to run in the cloud, which cloud provider? Because each cloud provider, it's database as a service or not database as a service. And if your database is a service, which version of the database is a service? Like in the case of Amazon, there's RDS MySQL, there's RDS Aurora. Which one do you want? And depending on which one you choose, it might not be compatible with the other one, and it might not be compatible with other people's databases as service, or if you rolled your own. There's this massive matrix of different versions that you have to choose from, and that's really a problem because it's confusing. And I think with the Kubernetes space, it's also confusing as well. A lot of what we need to do as a community, as a group of technical people, is start to figure out best practices for each of these branches and start to consolidate and to try and commit ourselves to using open technologies that allow you to be portable and that allows you to vendor neutrality. It's the same thing in the K8 space. Is a lot of these you dive into, you get locked in, and then you're stuck. And to move out is really, really hard.
But there are two issues then once we've got all these databases in play. And that's assuming we've solved the management and everything else. The first and perhaps the most worrying is when you have customers here talking about having 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 plus database instances, that data breach landscape, I'm not sure I would ever sleep.
Oh my gosh, it's so massive. That is just a crazy thing. Right now, you can't go a day without seeing a database breach. There are so many out there, so many databases out there, so many attack points. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And that scares a lot of people. That scares me. When you ask people about what keeps you up at night, it's interesting because a lot of DBAs don't think this. We did a survey. We asked customers last year, and this is not this particular survey, but we asked, what keeps you up at night? The DBAs were like, oh, performance issues, outages. Like anybody in management or executive was like, security, right? Like, oh my God, security is so bad. But when we're talking about 10,000 instances across multiple providers, across multiple setups, part of this is the automation. This is where automation can help or hurt. Automating and getting consistency. A lot of companies are striving for that consistency across their fleet of databases. If they know that database A is secure, then if they can replicate that security for B, C, D, and all the way through to the end, that is something that gives them some comfort, and they know that that becomes bulletproof. The problem is if it is insecure and you multiply it by 10,000 times, that gets really worse. A lot of the breaches that we see nowadays are not caused by like some deep-rooted problem. They're caused by apathy, caused by misunderstanding, caused by not being educated on the products that people are using. 1A and 1B databases that get breached, Elasticsearch and MongoDB. Why? Because by default, their security models aren't strong enough. For years, MongoDB has not required a default password. When you see like MongoDB database breach, you see the password wasn't set or it was left open or things like that. There is a lot of that lack of understanding of how this technology works. I don't blame the vendors. I blame the people who have deployed for not understanding. Mm-hmm. This gets back to lowering the barrier of entry for a lot of folks to get into technology. People start using that technology. They don't understand it. They deploy something and then boom.
But there's a catch-22 here. We just talked about how Kubernetes has made it easier for people to do things. The cloud has made it easier. We've moved away from this need to massively configure by writing code applications to make them work to a world where we're told, oh, it's three or four things that you tick on a box and it'll run in the cloud. Yet all of the EC3 instances we see, they're caused by misconfiguration. So how do you step in as a database vendor and say, okay, at one point we can make our database secure by requiring a default password, but actually here are the best practices for deployment to the cloud for configuration on those platforms?
You mentioned Kubernetes. We built our operators where we set them up with the best practices already. So when you want to spin up your databases, you'll get those best practices that we've discovered through our customers and through our users. That secure by default is the first step. Doesn't mean you're going to catch everything. There's a lot of zero-day type stuff that happens, but that is the first basis, is you want to make sure that what you're running is secure by default. You also want to ensure that people have the education and knowledge. I'm a big fan of really helping customers and helping users in three different ways. Number one, I want to give you the self-education, do it yourself. Mm-hmm. We have our blog. We have the conferences that we're here for. We have webinars. We try to give away as much free education as possible because it behooves us to have everyone out there running databases in a safe, secure way. I don't want my stuff breached. I know you don't want your stuff breached. We want to keep it secure. So we're going to give you all the education. So it's important to make sure no matter what you do, you're meeting customers where they want to be met, and some of those want to just do it themselves. So that education is perfect. We also offer people the ability to have a guided thing. We have software, like our PMM software, that helps identify issues and gaps, but we also have what we call technical account managers that we put in with some customers who can be their open source database spirit guide. So they can guide you to the right location, the right spot, give you the advice that you need to be successful. And then we also have our full turnkey stuff. So if you just want to say, you know what, I want an expert to run it and make sure it's secure, here you go. Take it, run with it. We're fine with that. I think it's important to know that everyone's a little different, and how you're going to run something is different than how I'm going to run it. And if we can make sure everyone has the right education, the right materials, the right way to do it, I think we'll all be successful.
I mentioned there were two challenges for database. The second one, which I haven't touched on, plays partly to this. It plays partly to other things we've talked about. We, if we look at DNS, see an awful lot of DNS poisoning attack. As we see customers with more and more instances trying to synchronize them across multiple clouds, multiple platforms, it opens the door for poisoning of data. We already have the challenge of, do you trust that data? Is the data in that version of the database the most accurate or not? But now I have the opportunity for somebody to get in and interfere. When you're doing that training, when you're talking to customers, when you're telling them how to configure this for multiple replications, a massively scalable replication, how much does that risk of a bad actor getting into that sequence and altering data weigh on people's minds?
There's different levels. You have to look at the different attack vectors. From the infrastructure side, so from the pure infrastructure side, that's where, if you're using a cloud provider, their shared responsibility model, they totally lock down the infrastructure, which is great, and they can protect you from there. From a database perspective, if you're running databases, a lot of the database vendors, ourselves included, will implement different technologies to help make sure database replication between databases is secure and it's got encrypted channels. But the biggest attack vector is still on that application side, and it's on the side that steps above. And this is where we start to see things like technology like proxy SQL or proxy servers that can sit in and look for certain attacks or look for SQL injection type issues and prevent those. We're also looking at some things that provide some data masking and some other technologies to help prevent if someone does get access, they can't do anything with it. But really, the responsibility for a lot of this ends up in the application side. And a lot of it is, hey, you have to develop your application knowing these things and protecting these things. It's a multi-layer, multi-depth, defense in depths. You have your infrastructure. You have to make sure that's bulletproof. Your database has to be bulletproof. The database design has to be bulletproof. You have to make sure, like I said, it's encrypted. You data mask. You check for SQL injection. Then you have to build the application. So it's that depth in design that has to be built into every application. That's something that we always advise. You have to look at multiple things. But that application side, it's really difficult because you've got way more developers than you have database folks and sysadmins. Way more. There's a lot of different places and a lot of different ways to educate those folks.
It's funny, isn't it? I remember the late 1980s, early 1990s, where we tried to make every developer a DBA.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it seems to solve this problem, we've got to go back there. Matt, thank you for talking to us today.
Thanks a bunch.